Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, November 26th. I'm Lisa Music reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, freeze watch in effect overnight as temps plummet. California tribal nations unite to protect ancestral ocean territories. And navigating California's insurance crisis, hope on the horizon. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. As temperatures are expected to dip below freezing overnight, the National Weather Service has issued a freeze watch for the coastal areas of Del Norte, Humboldt, and Mendocino counties, as well as the interior of Humboldt and Del Norte. We turn to Matthew Tidwell, lead meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Eureka, for the details.
We have a frost advisory out for tonight in most of the coastal areas, and then northern Humboldt interior and northern Del Norte interior. And with those, we're expecting temperatures to get down to 33 to 36 degrees in those areas. The tricky part about tonight is whether fog will form. You know, we've got a lot of standing water around and even just really moist ground, so that might keep some areas from getting as cold as they might otherwise.
Though interior temps are expected to plummet, with Garberville forecast to fall to 32 degrees, Covelo to 27 degrees, and Hayfork to a chilly 23 degrees, those areas are not part of the freeze watch. Tidwell explained why.
We work with the agricultural commissioners of the counties to determine when pretty much the growing season is considered over. And I believe in interior Humboldt, I think that's considered over in November 1st. So after that date and after we have a killing freeze in the valleys, then we end these products for the year, because these frost and freeze products are mainly for agricultural or gardening interests. And so once you get into the winter, we stop those.
Though the agricultural-centric freeze watch is only in effect in some areas of the forecast region, those in areas where temperatures are expected to dip near or below freezing should anticipate impacts.
Well, certainly black ice might be a problem in the colder spot, especially if the roadways are still wet. You know, probably tonight would be the biggest risk of that. You know, things are still kind of damp, but it may be dry enough that they'll cool off.
The determining factor of exactly what areas will see the most impact from the forecasted lower temperatures will be fog.
Tonight will be kind of tricky. You know, the areas that are dry enough will probably see near freezing temperatures or freezing temperatures in the interior, but they might fog up too.
After days of rain from a bomb cyclone system that brought prolonged heavy rain to the area, the water faucet has apparently been turned off. Tidwell shares details on this turnabout in weather conditions.
Yeah, well, the main thing is we've really switched patterns. And, you know, where we had, you know, 10 to 12 inches of rain here in Eureka in November, now the next 2 weeks look dry. At this point, we're fairly confident that at least the next week is going to be dry. And even into the following week looks pretty dry. So it's a pretty abrupt change, but hopefully people can enjoy the sunshine a little bit after all that rain.
To view the freeze watch maps, visit our website at kmud.org. Given the chance to recommend a ban on synthetic netting on cannabis farms, Humboldt County Planning Commissioners chose a less restrictive option instead. Daniel Mentz reports.
Balancing environmental concerns and the needs of cannabis farmers, the Humboldt County Planning Commission supports requiring best management practices for use of synthetic netting. At its November 21st meeting, the commission weighed several options, including an outright ban, as it considered changing how the county regulates plastic and nylon monofilament netting. Synthetic netting is used to stabilize plants as fencing and for erosion control. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife, CDFW, is concerned about improper use, storage, and disposal of netting. The CDFW's warnings about net fragments washing into waterways and snaring of wildlife are heeded in county permitting, but because prohibitions and restrictions on netting aren't written into the county's cannabis ordinances, they get applied as conditions of approval in discretionary permits. Non-discretionary cannabis cultivation permits aren't subject to that, which makes application of the requirements inconsistent and arguably unfair. The commission seeks to develop across-the-board regulations, and Commissioner Lorna McFarlane suggested doing so in a way that farmers can live with.
There are a lot of statewide laws that are now in effect that started with county measures. And so, you know, someone's got to start that train, whether it's smoking or the plastic bag ban. And so I do agree that it has to start somewhere. That being said, I do recognize we don't want to put another restriction on an industry that, you know, is a big part of our county. So I think that finding a middle ground would be the most appropriate. Like, I don't want to completely rule it off the table. So I think finding a middle ground, really focusing on that waste, would be the way to go.
Before the commission were two options: banning synthetic netting or to develop regulations specifying conditions on use, storage, and disposal. Commissioner Ivor Skavdal had doubts about selective targeting of the cannabis industry, saying, quote, "That is, in fact, what causes businesses not to come before us to seek permits and, in fact, drive some of them away from us." During a public comment period, cannabis farmers and consultants said most cannabis farmers use netting responsibly, and overregulation has hobbled the local cannabis industry. Natalyn DeLapp of the Humboldt County Growers Alliance noted the permitting inconsistencies and strongly advised against a ban.
We are a highly, highly regulated industry. And, you know, as already mentioned in the staff report, plastic trellis is only prohibited in erosion control. And this has then been an additional add-on that the Planning Commission has only put on discretionary permits. You know, and I just want to say, trellis is so important that our county's Economic Development Department named Project Trellis after trellis, because it's such an integral part of our industry. So to talk about the alternatives, alternative one, just the blanket prohibition, would be absolutely devastating. Please do not go down that route.
Commissioners didn't show interest in a ban, as talked about here by Commissioner Jerome Kiriazzi.
The reason for the regulation is because there is a few that ruined it for the rest of us, right? There's why we have these kinds of regulations. You know, all that said, I completely agree. I'm not interested in punishing farmers that are using this correctly. It's a useful tool, and it's important for their work. And so if there's farmers that are managing it and using it and disposing it correctly, then I don't see a reason why we need to take that away from farmers.
Commissioners unanimously voted to recommend requiring best management practices in an ordinance amendment that would be approved by the Board of Supervisors. Also at the meeting, commissioners approved permits for Southern Humboldt resident Joshua Sweet's existing 61,000-square-foot cannabis farms in the hills east of Garberville. The permits include restoration work related to three ponds that state agencies took enforcement action on. A court case resulted in a settlement involving payments and decommissioning of the ponds. There were issues raised about the legality and impacts related to use of access roads, but after being reassured by planning staff, the commission unanimously approved the permits. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Three tribal nations in Northern California have made history with the signing of a groundbreaking agreement to protect and restore their ancestral ocean territories. Last Friday, the Tulawa Dene Nation, Pulikla Tribe of Yurok people, and Sherry Heights Indian Community of the Trinidad Rancheria signed an intertribal treaty of stewardship and responsibility. This treaty formalizes their collaboration to manage, protect, and restore the Yurok Tulawa Dene Indigenous Marine Stewardship Area, or IMSA. The IMSA, established last year, is the first marine protected area in the United States created by tribal governments. Stretching from the Oregon-California border to south of Trinidad in Humboldt County, it safeguards marine species of cultural and ecological significance, including salmon, eels, clam, and kelp. The area also supports California's goal of achieving biodiversity conservation by 2030. Talawa Dini Chairperson Jerry Lynn Thompson said, quote, "Together, we will endeavor to protect and restore the biodiversity, water quality, and natural habitats within the IMSA, ensuring the sustainability of our traditional practices and the resilience of our communities. By this treaty, we reaffirm our sovereignty and the sacred responsibility bestowed upon us at creation to be stewards of this world," end quote. A ceremony held at the Heights Casino in Trinidad saw 60 members of the three tribes gather to witness their leaders commit to protecting this vital area. Tribal Chairperson Fawn C. Murphy of the Palikla tribe highlighted the importance of their efforts, stating, quote, "Tribal nations have always taken care of our ocean and coastal territories. Signing this treaty today demonstrates our leadership and commitment to protecting tribal culture and restoring ocean health," end quote. The treaty includes agreements to respect each other's sovereignty, share governance responsibilities, and use indigenous traditional knowledge to guide their actions. The tribes also invite other indigenous nations with ties to the area to join the effort in the future. Chairperson Garth Sundberg of the Trinidad Rancheria emphasized the importance of this treaty for future generations, saying, quote, "The signing of the IMSA treaty makes a milestone in our shared journey to protect and restore our ocean and coastal territories that hold deep meaning and value for our people," end quote. This historic collaboration serves as a reminder of the power of tribal leadership in addressing environmental and cultural challenges. To learn more about the IMSA and the treaty, visit the Talawa Dene Nation's website at talawa-nsn.gov. Turning to Mendocino, a minor altercation at Fort Bragg Middle School escalated into a significant police response earlier this fall, raising questions about the role of law enforcement on school campuses and sparking community conversations about racism and safety. KZYX's Elise Cox brings you the details.
Usually, a shoving match during recess at a local middle school would not make the news. But what happened at the Fort Bragg Middle School on September 30th was unusual. A minor altercation in the schoolyard triggered a police response involving multiple officers, provoking accusations of racism and an ongoing community process. In this newscast, Superintendent Joseph Aldridge shares details of the event that have not previously been made public. Aldridge also discusses the ongoing effort to engage the community and gather input regarding the practice of assigning an armed, uniformed police officer to the district, as well as an effort by the school to educate students about racism and its impact. Here's the superintendent.
So to set the record straight, at least from what I can share, as you said, is that on September 30th, we were heading into our lunchtime. Our assistant principal just felt that there was kind of some unrest on our middle school campus, nothing that was a specific concern, but just kind of generally thought that it would be nice for our school resource officer to come out and just have a presence on the campus, as he had done other times during lunch, just to be there. And genuinely, he was on the campus handing out stickers to students when a fight broke out right next to him. I mean, within arm's reach, really. And he responded to that. And during that time, he radioed in to dispatch saying that he was responding to a fight. And then he became engaged with the student at that point, not in any, just in de-escalation, trying to get the student to relax and to just kind of walk away from the fight, hopefully. And during that time, he was unable to radio in to the dispatch. As a result, the police protocol in that situation is to send all available officers to the last known location for that officer. And so they did. And so we ended up with a much larger response to something that is a pretty typical school incident that happened.
I asked the superintendent to set the stage.
No, okay. Yeah, this incident happened outside during our lunch period. So, you know, when students are out on the yard and you know, enjoying stretching their legs and doing all that kind of thing. So just their kind of during their social time during the day. This happened in shortly, you know, kind of outside of our cafeteria area. There were two students involved in this particular situation, and one had said something untoward about the other's sibling. And so that's kind of what started the altercation in this situation. There were words, and students were redirected, you know, by the adults who were nearby the situation. And then a group of students left and then returned shortly thereafter. And that's when the physical part of the altercation began. So the officer tried the de-escalation techniques and then eventually had to put the student in a seated position on the ground. The student was not hurt during that exchange. It was not a forceful thing.
This is not the version of the incident that was repeated to me by three community members.
The student was never hogtied. That did not happen. Thank you for acknowledging that as well. And the student was also resistant when he was asked to move to another part of the campus. And so that's when other officers had to intervene and help the officer carry the student out to the front of the campus at that point.
The student whose sister was called a name, who was made to sit on the ground, and who was carried to the front of the school, is a member of a minority group. And this was triggering for numerous adults. And while this particular incident didn't involve the use of a racial or ethnic slur, kids do use that kind of language. We'll talk about how these get dealt with in a moment, but first, the main issue the community raised was whether the presence of a uniformed, gun-toting officer at a middle school was really necessary.
So we've taken the feedback from our community, and we're really trying to, we've put a pause.
The school resource officer program was stopped, and the officer was removed from the campuses at least until the end of the year.
We're working through some of those protocols about better communication and just situations where, when should we actually call the school resource officer if we choose to put that program back in place.
The district restarted a safety committee that had gone dormant.
And that safety committee has been meeting fairly regularly. We're now to a point where we're trying to solicit parent input.
And to that point, the district sponsored a facilitated conversation with the community in early November. At the meeting, administrators explained that racial slurs are taken seriously.
Our procedure is our administrators work with that student to try to educate around the harm that racial slurs do cause to our students.
Students who use slurs and epithets are required to read articles, watch TED Talks, and then to present to a panel. The district also takes the position that when a child acts up, it's sometimes because something is happening at home.
The school resource officer was just part of a suite of things that we offer to students, including we've got a program that's just coming online that will be real-time counseling for students and families that they can get enrolled within 48 hours to get to see a counselor. And that can last up to 12 weeks at no cost to them.
There'll be another community meeting in January.
And this is all building towards hopefully having a very comprehensive district safety plan where everyone understands their roles and addresses all the concerns that need to be addressed within that.
For KZYX News, I'm Elise Cox.
As rural property owners grapple with soaring premiums and non-renewals, a recent forum in Laytonville offered actionable steps to mitigate wildfire risks, potential discounts, and insights into new strategies aiming to stabilize California's beleaguered insurance market. Sarah Reith reports.
Welcome to the Mendocino County Fire Safe Council podcast. We hope this series will help you learn how to survive and thrive in a wildfire-prone environment. Everyone knows that California, like many other states, is in the midst of an insurance crisis. The pressing questions are, what can property owners do to bring costs down, and is there help on the horizon? On the eve of the season's first atmospheric river, dozens of Laytonville residents made their way to Harwood Hall for a forum about how they could navigate the insurance quagmire. The Mendocino County Fire Safe Council, the Department of Insurance, and United Policyholders, a nonprofit consumer rights and education organization, sent representatives to take questions and offer information. Attendees learned that under the terms of a 2022 regulation called Safer from Wildfires, They can be eligible for insurance discounts if they create defensible space around their homes and take steps to make their structures more fire resistant. And since one of the risk factors in a fire is how well the neighbors have prepared to meet disaster, FireWise and fire risk reduction communities also come in for a break. With insurance harder and more expensive to obtain, it's more essential than ever not to lose your home. The California Department of Insurance is rolling out its sustainable insurance strategy, an agreement it says could go into effect by the end of the year. The DOI cannot compel companies to do business anywhere, but if the current plan succeeds, insurance companies that have left the state might be enticed to start writing policies in wildfire-prone areas again. The plan is currently under review by the Office of Administrative Law. Rural areas have been especially hard hit by insurance non-renewals. Mendocino County is one of 28 counties in the state that the Department of Insurance has designated a distressed area, meaning that insurance companies have rated more than 20% of the properties at high or very high risk of wildfire. Top insurance companies like Allstate, State Farm, and Farmers have at times stopped writing new policies in California. This leaves the FAIR plan, originally intended as the insurance of last resort, as the only available option for many people. The FAIR plan is a high-risk pool that only covers basic fire protection for people who can't find another option. It's bare bones and usually more expensive than traditional insurance. Within Mendocino County, Laytonville is one of the zip codes deemed especially distressed, with a FAIR plan penetration rate of 15% or more. Duriya Syed, an outreach analyst with the DOI, told attendees that the commission requires transparency so that property owners can request that their insurers provide them with their fire risk score. This may help them get a clearer idea of what they need to do to mitigate against fire. Still, sometimes the decision about whether or not to insure a property is made by the reinsurance market, the entities that insure the insurance companies, which seems to mean that even the insurance companies cannot always be sure which policies they want to insure will be approved. The DOI hopes that its sustainable insurance strategy will bring about significant changes in how insurance is calculated. Currently, California requires insurance companies to use historical data to determine risk. That means companies cannot use catastrophic modeling, which incorporates estimates predicting future risk based on expectations about the effects of climate change or the likelihood of wildfire in a particular area. The DOI wants insurers to commit to insuring more properties in high-risk areas in exchange for being allowed to use catastrophic modeling, which the industry believes is more accurate. These models are the focus of a new strategy group chaired by Cal Poly Humboldt Dean of the College of Natural Resources, Eric Riggs. The group plans to provide Insurance Commissioner Ricardo Lara with its recommendations about the catastrophic models in April 2025. The new strategy would also require insurance companies that use the models to take into account wildfire mitigation actions like home hardening and defensible space. Companies that don't meet their obligations under the plan could be prevented from using catastrophic modeling in the future. The DOI believes its plan will improve the situation but does not expect it to be a quick fix. In the meantime, homeowners complain that their insurance sometimes costs more than the mortgage, that increases can be substantial every year, and that they've been denied coverage in spite of all their best mitigation efforts. Annie Barber of United Policyholders advises rigorous documentation of all communications with insurance representatives. Follow up all conversations with an email, she urged. Make sure you have a record of your belongings. Develop a thorough understanding of the value that's placed on the loss of use if your home burns down. She encouraged renters to insure their belongings in case they lose them in a disaster. A Tubbs fire survivor herself, Barber's research includes personal experience. She strongly advocated finding a local insurance broker who will be an aggressive ally in finding the best deal, though the best deal may still be somewhat grim in the midst of an insurance crisis. Barber spoke with us after the insurance forum. Can you give us a big picture idea of what this plan is and what it's ideally going to accomplish?
So the Department of Insurance has put a sustainability product together of sorts, a plan. And what it's supposed to do and what we have to do first is to make insurance available. As opposed to affordability, because if you can't get insurance, it doesn't matter how affordable it is. So the way they have it planned out is for, they have allowed the insurance companies to bring in reinsurance costs and catastrophic modeling. which we have not allowed to be passed on to the consumer. We're one of just a couple of states that have dug our heels in on that. Obviously, those two things raise the rates of insurance. But by doing that, the California Department of Insurance feels that that will open up the insurance industry again so that people can get insurance. To go hand in hand with that, they're also having them make sure that they get the amount of California Fair Plan down to a reasonable rate. We're at 4% right now. It needs to be way lower than that. So that's part of the negotiation. They will take more of the higher risk areas and bring that price down.
And the catastrophic modeling is a big deal because it takes into account things like climate change and the fires that are expected based on scientific predictions rather than, well, this part of town hasn't burned down before, but it's a different era.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It used to just be historic modeling, and that was pretty basic. This area hasn't burned, therefore you can't charge me extra.
The huge takeaway that I got from you was shop, 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 shop around for brokers. And of course, there are limited brokers and limited options in small rural areas. And I think Santa Rosa also qualifies as a small rural area, even though it's much more cosmopolitan than most of us up here.
Every area has these little rural pockets that are struggling. Even San Francisco is having challenges with having their insurance non-renewed. So it's no longer just a rural issue. It's encompassing everybody. We've been in an insurance crisis for quite a while. And you don't get there and then just turn it around overnight. But we're hearing this across the board. We go into the park fire. Many people were non-renewed in June or July, and they didn't have insurance. The major issue, right? Our number one asset in life is our homes. It's our one, number one thing that we can depend on, that we can quote unquote control. And people are struggling to do that now.
So tell a little bit of details about your work. It looked like you were kind of trying to snap up some recruits from the crowd who were like, what can we do to solve this? So what can we do?
United Policyholders has three programs. We have our Roadmap to Preparedness, which is what I did tonight, trying to educate people about insurance so they know what they're looking at when they can get insurance or how they can streamline it to lower the price of their insurance. We have a Roadmap to Recovery, where we come in right after a disaster and we help people navigate their insurance. And then we have our Advocacy. Advocacy is important for everybody, obviously. We would like to be a bigger voice than we are. Anybody who'd like to help is welcome to email me at ANNIE@uphelp.org. And as we come up with ways to help, we will tap into that.
The Mendocino County Fire Safe Council also recommends visiting both wildfireprepared.org for information about which steps the insurance industry recommends to protect your home, and the Home Hardening video series on its own, www.firesafemendocino.org webpage. If you'd like to learn how to protect your home from wildfire, which could eventually earn you an insurance discount, you can schedule a free property assessment from the Mendocino County Fire Safe Council. You're encouraged to get your neighbors involved, so inspectors can assess a few homes in one day. This is a non-judgmental, non-binding, non-regulatory, risk-free educational experience where you can also learn about opportunities for free or reduced-cost defensible space work. For more information, call 707-462-3662 or email admin@firesafemendocino.org. For a full recording of the insurance forum at Harwood Hall, you can go to the Mendocino County Fire Safe Council's Facebook page. Thanks for tuning in to the Mendocino County Fire Safe Council podcast.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Katie Phillips, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Elise Cox, and Sarah Reif. Reporting from the K-Mud Studio in Redway, I'm Lisa Music.